It was 12:15 a.m. A paper cup half full of cold coffee sat beside the vending machine pimento cheese sandwich Remy had brought Lisette before heading out at the end of visiting hours. The unopened plastic wedge that held the sandwich pointed like a planchette toward the silent, glowing flat-screen television built into the dark wood veneer cabinet to her left. To her right, a man lay stretched out on the short leg of the gray, padded, L-shaped banquette. He snored softly. Mama? A single-word text from Manon popped up on her phone. Lisette typed her response. Yes, baby. Mama's here. And then she waited for what seemed a thousand years.
I need you. Can you come?
Then I know it's late. Mama is just downstairs, Lisette responded, then worried that might sound presumptuous. I knew you didn't want to see me, but I was hoping. She'd already scrambled to her feet as she typed the first response, but now she paused, frightened she might have put Mana off. Another eternity passed. Her answer finally came.
I love you. I'm sorry.
It had been worth the wait. Lisette ran toward the elevator bank, not worrying whether she looked like a madwoman, not worrying about displaying her remarkable recovery in the very hospital where she'd been treated after her stroke. She darted into an elevator car before its doors had fully opened. She caught sight of her blurred reflection as the doors closed. She had developed a new nervous tic overnight, tugging down the sleeve of her sweater to make sure the god remained hidden. She gave in to the urge once more, knowing it would help her regain her composure before the doors opened on the maternity ward. The staff wouldn't look too well on a grandmother who was foaming at the mouth. Isidore was waiting for her when she stepped out. He looked worse than exhausted, unshaven, rumpled, still wearing the same shirt and jeans he had had on when Michael had summoned them to the hospital. He motioned with a thumb over his shoulder.
She's that way, he said,
his voice hushed in deference to both the setting and the hour.
Three doors down on the left. You talked her into seeing me? Lisette said,
doing her best not to let her anxiety punch up the volume of her voice. Isidore rubbed his hand down his face, then gave her a wan smile.
No, I know better than to try talking either of you into anything. She came around on her own.
He stepped around her and pressed the call button for the elevator.
Are you coming with me?
Her voice had started out low, but rose till her last word pealed like a bell. The attendant at the nurse's station lifted his finger to his lips. Lisette mouthed the word,
sorry.
No, Isidore whispered. It's past visiting hours. Only one of us can stay with her, and she wants her mama.
He leaned in and planted a kiss on her forehead.
Don't be scared, he said. The storm is over.
How can you be so sure?
I've got decades of experience predicting the weather, he said,
as the elevator doors opened. He stepped into the car, then turned back. As the doors began to close on him, he leaned forward.
After all, like mother, like daughter.
Any other day, she might have bristled at his parting quip. Tonight, the familiarity of his good-natured ribbing comforted her. Lisette was, she realized, afraid. Afraid she might make a misstep, that she might say or do something that would set her fragile daughter off and alienate her once again. She turned, bracing herself for whatever was to come. She made her way down the hall, the soles of the new sneakers she had bought to replace her blood-soaked pair squeaking with each step. In the lobby, where it didn't matter one whit, they'd lived up to their name. Here, they seemed determined to compete with Gabriel's trumpet.
Lisette approached the opening of the third door and peered in. The subdued nighttime lighting revealed Manon wasn't in bed, as Lisette would have expected at this hour. Instead, she sat in the guest chair, waiting for her. Manon wore a robe, a new one Lisette had never seen, pastel pink with oversized white and yellow daisies, and matching padded slippers. Lisette couldn't imagine anything less like her daughter. Maybe Isidore had sent Remy out to do the shopping, or maybe one of Manon's school friends had dropped off the ensemble. From her own stint at this same hospital, Lisette knew anything was better than the ass flaps and the wind gowns they gave you to wear. Lisette stepped over the threshold and waited, studying her daughter for any signs she wasn't happy to see her. Manon's gaze, at first distant, sharpened as it registered her presence.
"I am so scared, Mama," she said,
holding out a hand that Lisette rushed over to grasp.
"How am I going to do it?"
Manon's shoulders hunched forward, and her chin dropped nearer her chest. She seemed to be crumbling in on herself.
"How am I going to love this baby? What if I can't?"
Lisette squeezed her daughter's hand, then lifted it to her lips. Manon's eyes drifted up to hers, full of the same expectant look she used to get as Lisette patched her up from some childhood accident. She wanted her mother to promise her everything would be all right, maybe even expected it. But this wasn't a scraped knee. Sweet nothings would get them nowhere. Maybe Lisette's father was right. Maybe the child would be better off with a different family, a normal family that knew nothing of magic. She felt her heart tighten in her chest at the thought. She didn't believe it. Not really. Despite everything, Lisette felt the baby girl would be better off with them. Despite everything, she didn't think it would take an intervention from Ursulie Mercer to open Manon's heart.
"How?"
Lisette began, reaching out, stroking Manon's hair. "Do you feel when you look at her?" Manon pulled back.
"I haven't seen her. It's wrong of me, I know. I need it. I need you to go with me."
Lisette nodded. "That's why I'm here, to help you do whatever it is you need to do, regardless of what that is." Manon's focus softened, but a crease formed between her brows.
"What if she doesn't live?"
"Of course she's going to live." Lisette spoke as if that were the most nonsensical thing her daughter had ever said, then forced a smile. She wanted to tell Manon that her being near the child, loving her, would probably play as big a role in her survival as anything the doctors could do. She knew better than to say it, though. If the child lived, that would be one thing. If the child died, she would have saddled Manon with a lifetime of questioning, a lifetime of guilt. "When can we go?" she asked. Manon stared at her blankly.
"Go?"
"To see the baby."
"Oh."
Manon gave a small nod.
"The nurse, she said any time. They got her in a private room in the NICU. They do that here,"
Manon said, then choked.
"For the most fragile ones."
The nurse, a young woman wearing blue hospital scrubs, met them as they approached the baby's room. Lisette imagined she saw a look of relief in the woman's black eyes.
"She's been waiting to see you,"
the nurse said. Then, seeming to read something in Manon's expression, she moved into business mode. "I'll need you both to wash your hands."
She handed Lisette two plastic bags, each containing a sky blue disposable gown, made, it seemed, from the same material as the bags in which they were packaged. And put these over your clothes. The woman paused as she went to a sink stationed in the hall outside the row of private nurseries and turned on the water. Lisette at first assumed it was for them, but then the nurse soaped up her own hands and put them under the stream. You're feeling healthy, right? This question was aimed at Lisette. Truth be told, Lisette felt like she had ridden an express train halfway to dead, but she knew the nurse needed to be sure the baby wouldn't be exposed to infection. Tired, Lisette allowed herself a partial confession. But no, I've been well. Other than the stroke that nearly killed me and the self-surgery I've done on my arm. The nurse's face flashed a doubtful expression, her mouth pulling into a pinched, tight line as her gaze zeroed in on Lisette. For a moment, Lisette wondered if the woman had picked up on the thoughts she hadn't expressed, at least not aloud. You sure? It's crucial. I am. I'm sure. I'm sorry. It's only I've been... Lisette paused and wrapped her arm around Manon's shoulders. We've been going through hell. The nurse nodded, her features smoothing, losing any air of suspicion. I understand, she said. But the words sounded perfunctory, as if she didn't understand at all.
She's so small, Manon said, seemingly surprised. So small, she repeated herself, this second time with fear building in her voice.
She's a fighter, the nurse said, speaking with a sterner tone than Lisette would have liked. That's what she is. The woman reached a hand into each of the incubator's hand ports. She needs to know she's got someone to fight for. No one could fault the nurse on her professionalism. She was working hard, though maybe not hard enough, to conceal her contempt for the mother who wouldn't be present for her daughter, for the grandmother who hadn't been present for hers. Lisette wanted to speak up, to try to explain their situation in a way that wouldn't prompt the nurse to make a call to Child Protective Services. The caretaker looked back over her shoulder at them. Place her hand like this, one on each side, and talk to her. She zeroed in on Manon. She knows your voice. Keep calm. Keep positive. Tell her how glad you are she's in the world. Tell her how much you love her. Manon's face crumbled, and fat tears traced down her cheeks.
I am, she said, seeming to realize the truth of her words as she spoke them. I do. I do love her.
The nurse's flinty eyes warmed, and a genuine smile twitched on her lips. Come here and tell her that. Lisette gave Manon a quick squeeze, then escorted her to the baby's incubator. The nurse nodded to Lisette as if to signal she had it from here. Perhaps it was selfish, but Lisette felt relieved the nurse's newfound warmth seemed to extend to her, too. It was as if the woman was willing to cut them some slack, now that she had determined them capable of human feeling. She led Manon, guiding her hands through the ports. There you are. Rest them by her sides. Manon beamed down at the tiny, fragile creature. Look. She knows you. See how she relaxed at your touch? Lisette hadn't noticed any change in the child's comportment, but she had nothing against a pious lie or two, especially in a situation such as this one. The nurse met her eyes, and in that instant, Lisette tried to telegraph a world of gratitude. A soft blink reminiscent of a satisfied cat seemed to serve as the nurse's acknowledgement. The woman placed a hand between Manon's shoulder blades. I'll be right outside if you need me. Thank you, Lisette said, this time aloud. Manon stirred as if from a dream. She mumbled, "Yes, thank you." Her focus never straying from the baby. Lisette and Manon stood there without speaking for a few golden minutes, taking in the miracle in the plastic box. With relief came exhaustion. The room was spacious, with a recliner for the parents to use once the baby was far enough along to be held, and a padded bench that ran along a good portion of the far wall. Lisette took a seat on the bench and waited. Lisette didn't want to speak, for fear she had fractured the spell the child was weaving on the mother. Finally, Manon broke the silence.
"I was thinking I might name her Joy," she said, "after Grandma Perot.
I think that would make your father very happy." The thought made Lisette happy, too. Joy Perot had been a good woman. Lisette couldn't have hoped for a better mother-in-law. She cursed the breast cancer that had taken Joy from them. Isidore's mother had always been a bit on the quiet side. She had grown up in the north, the Chicago area, with her widowed mother, Lucille, and another woman Lisette now realized had been Lucille's partner. Joy's older brother had been a naval officer stationed at Great Lakes. It was he who had introduced Joy to Isidore's father. Joy did have a couple of odd quirks. She was terrified by the scent of carnations and refused to set foot in the state of Mississippi, even though her people, the Burks, were originally from a place there named Kilroy. No, Conroy. A dot on the map that had ceased to exist altogether after an explosion destroyed the paper mill that had been its main employer. Joy claimed her mother had forbidden her even to visit Mississippi. Said her mama had made that one stipulation before giving Joy her blessing to marry Isidore's father and move back below the Mason-Dixon line. Long before Lisette had ever considered Isidore in a romantic light, their families had known each other. Joy always treated Lisette's mother, Soulange, with a respectful, cautious deference, despite her uneasiness about Soulange's voodoo. Though she had never once set foot in Vevey, she hadn't been above coming to Soulange for counsel on everyday matters, or sitting next to her at Saturday Mass.
"Oh," Lisette said, as she realized the subtext encoded in the choice of name. Her mother-in-law's skill for being a part of the family, but not a part of Soulange's religion, had influenced the choice. Manon licked her lips. "I want a different kind of life for her, Mama. Not that I don't love and respect both you and Grandma Soulange. It's only, with her father being..."
"I get it, my girl. No need to explain." Lisette stood and drew near the incubator. She gazed down at the tiny life in the plastic box. "I want you both to distance yourself from witches and their magic. You can't do that if you follow in my footsteps." She traced a finger along the top of the incubator, pretending to herself she was touching the baby's cheek. "I've come to realize as long as a person is in service to the Luau, witches are going to be circling like buzzards, trying to pick at their power. These witches, they killed your grandmother. And they damned near killed the three of us, too."
"What about Vevey?"
"I know," she dared, as Lisette pondered her reply. "You were hoping I'd carry on the tradition." Lisette shook her head, thinking on what she had found when she had entered the store that morning. "No, ma chère. I don't think the Luau want you anyway. I think the mantle is falling to your brother." She sensed this to be true, and she also felt certain it was what Manon hoped to hear. Still, Lisette couldn't help but wonder if Manon might be the one who regretted this conversation one day. If after years of hiding the truth of who she was behind the less than glamorous realities of business management, there wouldn't come a time when Manon might crave a bit of magic. It's his choice to pick it up or walk away. All I can do is make sure he makes that choice with his eyes wide open. Manon smiled at Joy, for she was Joy now, not just the baby, and certainly never again it. Manon looked up at Lisette.
"Would you like to?" she said, taking her hands away from her little love. "I know it isn't the same as getting to hold her."
"I was," Lisette said, her heart flooding with love for both of her girls. "Afraid you were never going to ask." 15. Hugo claimed they had been invited to drop by, but Alice doubted the invitation extended to this late hour. The shutters of the house, a Gothic Revival double shotgun cottage, had been pulled closed, and the trio of lantern-like porch lights overhead was dark. She could see Hugo wouldn't be put off even by such obvious signs. He wanted to rake Nicholas over the coals, and to do so properly, he needed a larger audience. Alice stepped off the sidewalk into the street. Still booming a few blocks down, the street was subdued, if not entirely quiet, here on its more residential end. At least it was, until Hugo began rapping on the house's twin front doors, moving back and forth between them as he called out to the residents. If anything, this small gray house, crowned by a triangular central dormer that called to mind a traditional witch's hat, seemed too on the nose to belong to Les Jumeaux, or the twins, as they were called when the former felt too stilted. Of the once powerful Chanticleer coven, only the twins and the Marins remained, with no one left to cling to the pretension of maintaining French as the coven's official language. The twins would be unlikely to hear the French version of address moving forward. After so many years of thinking of the twins as a single unit, Alice had been almost surprised to learn they had given names as individuals. The sister went by Art, short for Artemis, and her minutes younger brother by Polly, an adaptation of Apollo. Apollo and Artemis, sun and moon. Even if the twins' parents had lacked the cold-blooded ambition shared by Alice's parents, they must have had some pretension to greatness. Thanks to the ever-cocky Hugo and the commotion he was causing on their darkened porch, curtains were shifting sideways and shades were being raised. Only they were in the neighboring houses. As far as the twins' house went, there was no sign of life.
"We should go," she called to Hugo. "They're probably asleep."
"Asleep?" Hugo said, looking back over his shoulder at her. "They're witches."
"Witches sleep?" Alice said, hearing the call of her own bed from only a few blocks away.
"Not the cool ones," he replied, and continued with his assault on the house. "I'll huff, and I'll puff, and I'll blow your house down."
The words crept into Alice's consciousness, causing her to smile, though the smile faded as soon as she realized the voice in which she had heard them spoken was Daniel's. The phrase came attached to a transient memory of crawling onto his lap and holding the book as he read aloud to her. But what began as memory grew feeble and was forced to rely on imagination for details. She couldn't say where actual history ended and wishful thinking began. She did remember, and this part was certain. Daniel had been very good at doing the wolf's voice. She was about to make a case for calling it a night when the porch lights flashed on, and, like a cuckoo clock striking the hour, both doors swung open at once. One twin stood in each doorway, dressed, not exactly to Alice's surprise, in matching short candy apple red silk peignoirs and white floral overlay boots, a crystal at the center of each white leather daisy. Atop their heads sat identical brunette beehive wigs, ratted high enough to house multiple colonies. They posed, turning slightly, one left, the other right, and raised the absinthe glasses in their right hands so the light spilling out through the open doors filtered through the cloudy, chlorophyll green spirit.
"Oh, for God's sake, guys," Hugo said. "Too much pageantry, not enough alcohol."
A curt, though still synchronized, spin on their heels, and the twins turned back into their house, leaving the doors open behind them.
"Left or right?" Hugo said, with a nod to each door.
"Does it matter?"
"Everything matters when it comes to magic. You of all people should know that."
He waited for her to choose, but when she hesitated, he tacked on an explanation.
"It's a little test they do, the first time someone comes to their house."
"All right, then," she said, nodding toward her choice. "Left." Hugo paused, eyebrows raising in surprise.
"Really? Are you sure?"
"Why shouldn't I be?" He shrugged.
"Not judging. Wait, that's a lie. I really am, but not entirely in a bad way."
"What is this a test of?"
"Oh, come on, really?" he said.
When she didn't reply, he laughed.
"It's pretty heavy-handed, and I'd assumed obvious. The left door, the left-handed path."
He paused, seeming to wait for a reaction.
"It's like a litmus test for someone's propensity to darkness, a kind of, are you a good witch or bad witch, appraising tool."
Alice didn't mean to cheat him out of his moment, but she had jumped a step ahead. Looking from one door to the other, she asked, "If the twins are testing you as you enter their house, wouldn't the left and right be from the interior perspective?"
"Oh,"
Hugo said, his mouth holding the shape of the sound long enough to show Alice she had managed to present him with an aspect of the situation he had never considered before. He pulled an exaggerated comic frown.
"I went in the other. Well, what the hell? Doesn't matter now."
He beckoned her with a wiggle of his finger, then said in a high, childlike voice,
"Why, I'm not a witch at all."
His pitch dropped to its regular register.
"Least I won't be for much longer."
Alice joined him on the porch as the overhead lights began to flash.
"All right, all right," Hugo growled. "Keep your tit clamps on."
He looked back at Alice.
"No, seriously, I can make out the chains beneath their robes."
Alice shook her head at him in mock disgust. Unaffected, he turned and bounded, perhaps by habit, through the right door. Alice paused to consider the choice once more, then followed in Hugo's footsteps.
"If this door is good enough for you," she called to her brother as she crossed the threshold, "it'll work for me too."
The twins turned to stare at her with dual blank befuddled expressions as Hugo threw his head back and roared out a laugh.
"I was only pulling your leg," he said,
reaching up to wipe a tear from his eye. Alice blushed and clenched her fists.
"You are an ass. You're an ass, that's what you are."
He drew closer and tapped the tip of her nose.
"I'm your big brother, and I have years."
He paused.
"Years,"
he repeated himself, stretching the word out into a ghostly moan.
"Of teasing to make up for."
"Oh," Alice said. "Lucky me."
Art arched one brow
and gave a small, slow shake of her head, a muted expression. Alice decided of sympathy. An almost imperceptible smile curled up on Polly's lips. It was a rare break in their mirroring of each other. Alice glanced around, taking in the room. Although most of the house appeared to maintain a true double shotgun layout, the twins, or someone before them, had knocked through the wall in the front room, creating a large shared space with chocolate brown walls and dark hardwood floors. The room seemed to center on a grouping of furniture. A low, three-legged, teardrop-shaped orange coffee table stood before a minimalist teal love seat and was flanked on one side by a pair of fuchsia velvet chairs. These, a bit too cleverly designed in the shape of fleur-de-lis. The far wall was devoted to a collection of ornate masks, most, Alice guessed, of Venetian origin. Hugo pointed himself toward this display.
"Father," he said, summoning Polly with a single shake of his curly blonde head. "Longest night. Masks."
It seemed a kind of shorthand existed between Hugo and the twins. Or maybe her brother had simply grown accustomed to getting his way with them without a belabored explanation. Hugo concluded with a somewhat sardonic, "Please." So maybe it was a little of both. All the same, it wasn't lost on her that Hugo had spoken of Nicholas as father. It was too late for her and Nicholas, but maybe it wasn't for Nicholas and his only surviving child. Alice only wished she didn't expect Nicholas to crush Hugo beneath his heel. Polly waved her forward toward the wall, an evident invitation to select whichever mask she'd like to borrow. Only one option stood out to Alice, a simple, squarish half-mask in bone white that called to mind the face of Babu Jean. Where she would have once found terror, she now felt an odd pang of longing.
"Would you care for some absinthe?" Art said.
Alice startled at the sound of her voice.
"Or perhaps something less decadent?" she added in response.
Alice guessed to her shocked expression. "No," Alice said, blushing once again. "It's only I'd assumed you weren't capable of speech."
"Really, Alice, what an absurd assumption on your part. After all, we are members of the Chanticleer Coven. You even heard us sing as part of the spell working at Celestin's charade of a funeral."
"I'm sorry. I'd assumed that was part of the magic."
"As a child," Polly jumped in, "I had a slight lisp. Our father suffered a great sense of shame because of it, seeing my lisp as evidence of this." He gestured from his beehive to his boots.
"This flawlessness?" Hugo finished the thought.
Polly's face lit up with pleasure at the compliment.
"You can be so sweet," he said,
then added in a lower tone,
"when you care to be."
Hugo shrugged.
"It comes at a cost."
He pointed across the room to a green glass bottle sitting on a dropleaf table, pushed up against and painted the same cocoa shade as the wall. Polly spun and turned his focus on her.
"Really, Madus, I can feel you limbering up to perform the mental acrobatics, and frankly, your efforts are exhausting me. He, she, him, her, I'm not trapped in the binary. On any given day, at any given hour, I myself might switch back and forth a dozen times. It matters far more to you than it does to me, so go with whatever you find the least taxing."
"I..." Alice began, embarrassed, realizing that in the back of her mind she had begun to search for a polite way to ask.
"Father used magic. He,
Yes, he, she decided, had already moved on. To try to fix me. Polly lifted his chin as if in defiance. When that failed, he took to mocking me without mercy. He badgered me to the point I also developed a significant stutter. After that, I stopped speaking altogether. His look of defiance fading, he smiled, almost apologetically, and reached up to pat the wig. Mother engaged a speech therapist, and after a few years of work, the cat returned my tongue to me. But by then, Art and I had perfected our silent communication. We found we could carry on full conversations with only a single shared mental image. So much faster and more precise.
I'm sorry, Alice said, filled with genuine regret for having resurrected painful memories, but also desperate for a graceful way to extricate herself from the awkwardness of the moment. I had no idea.
T'inquiète pas, chérie,
Art said, as she poured the green spirit into one of the half-dozen ringed glasses arrayed around the bottle and balanced a flat straining spoon on its rim. Father was a thoroughly detestable man, but justice was served in the end. She laid a sugar cube on the spoon and reached for a carafe just large enough to hold a half cup of liquid.
We cut out his tongue.
She began dripping water over the sugar. It seemed to be the fitting thing to do. After all, we were only children at the time. She glanced up with a bright smile.
He choked to death on his own blood.
She gave a slight nod toward Alice.
Right there on the floor where you're standing.
Alice took a quick step back, and her gaze fell to the floor as, in unison, Art and Polly began to titter, and Hugo let loose with a full snort. The three carried on, falling about, laughing, for a solid minute. To Alice, caught on the butt end of the joke, that minute seemed to stretch out into a dozen of them.
I do apologize, Art said, regaining composure, though nothing in her tone or her mirthful expression provided any evidence she felt regret. It's only I found your precious gullibility too tempting.
She removed the spoon from the glass and laid it on a coaster positioned between the bottle and a small silver bowl that, from Alice's vantage point, appeared to bear a different pattern than the spoon. Hugo walked over and reached for the glass, but Art snatched it back.
You reprobate, can wait. This is for the delightful Alice.
Alice felt anything but delightful. She hesitated.
Oh, chérie, don't pout. Think of our innocuous jest as your initiation ritual.
She crossed to Alice.
Felicitations, you passed.
Now, she proffered the glass.
Drink up.
You barely made it in under the wire. Under the wire? Alice said, lifting the glass to consider the now cloudy spirit.
Before the end of the world. My sister is certain the world, or at least our world, is spinning down like a top,
Polly said, and saluted her with his own glass.
That is why tonight, the last night before the final day, we drink absinthe.
He cocked his head.
Gin, gin.
Polly lifted the absinthe to his lips. Alice followed suit, taking a cautious sip. The spirit was at first spicy and dry, with the flavor of anise growing in prominence as the absinthe crossed her palate. The dissolved sugar battled with, but couldn't overcome, a salty, vegetal bitterness.
Wormwood, Art said,
answering a question Alice hadn't yet formed. She had returned to the table to mix Hugo's drink. When he took it from her,
Art turned back and fixed Alice with a mischievous look.
And the third angel sounded.
Hugo lifted his hand to his mouth, miming holding a horn.
Do-do-do-do!
Art smirked without taking her gaze off Alice. She continued.
And there fell a great star from heaven, burning as it were a lamp, and it fell upon the third part of the rivers, and upon the fountains of waters.
She paused for dramatic effect.
And the name of the star is called Wormwood, and the third part of the waters became Wormwood. And many men died of the waters because they were made bitter.
Absinthe,
Hugo said, stepping forward and assuming the deep, assertive voice of a commercial announcer.
The official drink of the apocalypse.
Alice regarded Art and Hugo, calculating how the pair might be planning to turn these remarks into yet another practical joke on her. She studied the liquid in her glass. But, Alice began, then paused to take another sip before finishing. That isn't really our apocalypse, is it?
No,
Art said, finishing her drink, returning to the stealthy table positioned near the wall. She swirled a bit of water in the glass, preparing it, Alice surmised, for another round, then emptied the water from her glass into the silver bowl.
It feels rather personal to me.
She smiled, though this time her smile didn't reach her black eyes. I don't understand.
Wormwood, Hugo said, holding up his drink to the light. It's also known as Artemisia, although Artemisia took its name from Artemis, the goddess, not our lovely,
he lingered on the word,
hostess.
Hugo grinned.
Our Artemis isn't quite that old.
Touché,
Art responded with a throaty laugh. She appeared genuinely amused rather than resentful of Hugo's quip. She sighed, then reached up to tug off her wig, revealing a nylon cap.
Pardon, frérot,
she addressed her brother. She dropped the wig on the table. He shrugged and removed his as well, then disappeared into another room for a minute, and returned without the wig. Alice sensed she had indeed passed some kind of rite of initiation with the twins for them to reveal themselves in any state short of perfection. Or maybe they really did believe the world was ending, and no longer cared.
Allons, mes enfants,
Polly called out with an operatic trill.
You've come to choose a mask that will disguise your true identity, or perhaps,
he paused and leered at them,
one to reveal it.
Well, Hugo said with an exaggerated sigh,
I was thinking either Bart Simpson or Vladimir Putin, but it looks like those options are out of stock.
Perhaps a zany, then,
Polly suggested.
He's alternately a clever trickster or a fool.
Hugo crossed to the wall, posing with his fist under his chin as he considered his options. He reached out and touched one of the masks, a golden monstrosity with an impossibly elongated nose.
This one. I'll take the gold plague doctor mask.
Oh, but that isn't a medico della peste,
Polly corrected him.
That is the zany. Traditionally, the longer the nose, the greater the fool. As you can see, this particular example has been blessed with a prodigious rhinal endowment.
Don't you remember? Art said, clasping her left hand over her right upper arm. The stance made her look like she was appraising a work of art. Polly responded with a slight rise of his eyebrows. On anyone else's face, Alice would have assumed the look a simple signal of amusement, but given the connection between brother and sister,
They could be carrying on a full conversation. Perhaps Polly didn't remember, or maybe he did, and he was warning his sister off.
Nicholas, Art continued, wore the zany mask to the last défilé de maléfique.
I'm sorry, she said, addressing Hugo. Please don't let that influence your choice. I shouldn't have said anything. Only I'm always surprised to find bits of my own mother still lurking in myself. She paused, as if to weigh her words.
We work so hard to exorcise our parents, to imagine ourselves as above both nature and nurture, self-generated, she said,
her gaze turning tender, as if she felt sympathy for Hugo.
But still, in the little things, in the areas where we're unguarded, blood will tell.
A chill ran down Alice's spine at the thought. 16. A look of caution passed between the twins.
We were aware Nicholas had returned, Art said. He paid us a visit earlier today.
Yes, Polly said. Far too early, in fact, but he always did keep such beastly hours.
He spoke as if returning to an oft-discussed subject, but Alice had no knowledge of how Nicholas spent his days. Art nodded.
True. It was from Nicholas I first learned there was a 7 in the AM, as well as the civilized hour.
He was on fire, Polly began, then rushed to add, figuratively, not literally, out to proselytize his last-minute plan to resurrect the longest night.
Polly reached up and ran a finger beneath his beige wig cap, scratching absent-mindedly.
Of course, we all know Nicholas never leaves anything till last minute. Unless, Hugo said, he doesn't want you to have long enough to think about what he's setting you up for.
For what it's worth, he professes to be racked with regret over the ways he's failed you. He wants to make amends to you, she said,
her gaze broadening to include Alice.
To you both.
An ambitious undertaking, Alice said, a self-conscious smile twitching on her lips. He could begin by letting us set him on fire, literally.
Indeed, Art replied,
her eyes opening a bit wider, her lips pursing into an amused pucker. She looked upon Alice with what appeared to be a new appreciation, as if she had only just begun seeing her as anything other than a piece of Hugo's luggage.
I'd wondered what you'd done with her, Hugo. With that marvelous creature who peeled back the gates of Pré-sur-Saint. I'd begun to think this one was a changeling. Welcome to the party, ma chère. This time, I mean it.
Polly batted his eyelashes.
Still, Nicholas's soliloquy pulled on the heartstrings. Really, it was wonderful theater. Shame he only offered a matinee performance. I'm sure.
Hugo's head tilted a little forward and to the side, one brow rising higher.
It fits Father's scheme, whatever he's up to now, for you to believe him.
Here's something you can believe, Art addressed Hugo. Every king needs an heir. You do matter to him, if only as an extension of himself.
That much I can give you.
Hugo took a drink and grimaced.
But he's not much of a king. At least, not anymore.
Ah, but that brings us back to the longest night, Art said. Your father has an agenda for wanting to revive it. One that goes beyond nostalgia or healing rifts.
Nicholas has a motive for everything he does, Alice replied. And it's never altruism, nor is it regret.
But what's he looking to get out of resurrecting this moldy bit of nostalgia? Hugo mused.
No need to speculate, mes chers, Polly said. He elaborated on his grand plan this morning.
Another quick glance passed between the twins.
He's found a solution, he believes, for our current troubles. One that's more sustainable than black market body parts.
In all fairness, Art said,
the words spoken in a mock conciliatory tone.
He was far humbler than that. He spoke of it as stopgap.
She paused, her focus drifting back to the zany mask.
To give the devil his due.
This time she sounded sincere.
His plan seems feasible. In fact, I'd say it stands a very good chance of working, provided one doesn't concern oneself too much with the ethics of the thing.
What brand of snake oil is the petit papa Nicholas selling? Hugo asked.
When it comes to magic, Art said, the power grid is failing. He's proposing to move the witches of New Orleans, those of us left, off the grid, and onto an alternative source.
It's a plan, Polly added. He purports to have stumbled upon after his disappearance. But if the scheme is as far along as it seems to be, it has taken some time to put in place.
Do tell, Hugo pressed.
How does Father plan on leading us into the promised land?
Art turned and crossed to the drinks table.
Much, she said,
spilling another round of absinthe into her glass.
As the good Dr. Dupas learned to draw power from his drugged clients, Nicholas intends to feed on the energy of those who come together to adore him.
Adore him?
Hugo said with a snort. Art looked to her brother to provide the explanation, then busied herself with dissolving sugar into her drink.
In short, Polly said, Nicholas is becoming a cult leader. It's easier than you might think. The hard part is channeling the power. Not many witches are capable of acting as a transformer. That's why Dr. Dupas created our old friend, Babu Jean, and lost control of him within months. A servitor spirit with that much power flowing through it will not remain a servitor for long.
Nicholas is eschewing any intermediary. He himself will be the focus.
Art took a sip of her drink, closing her eyes and smiling. All power will flow through him. She opened her eyes, but kept her focus on the glass in her hand.
As your grandfather sought to drain us,
your father has plans to recharge us tomorrow, although at this hour it's really tonight. He plans to use La Dafile to give us a taste of what he, if we accept him as our king, can offer.
Maybe we should skip this roving costume party, Hugo said, holding his empty glass up to Art.
Darling boy, she said. One per customer. You want another? Make it yourself.
Miss La Dafile? Not on your life, Polly said,
pulling several sheets of off-white packing paper from a box, then slipping the zany mask off the hooks that held it.
Truth is, I've missed the longest night. Despite Nicholas's machinations and our own Cassandra's, he cast an evil, narrowed-eye look at his sister. Predictions of certain and inescapable doom. I'm actually looking forward to it. Even if the world doesn't stop spinning, this could very well be the last longest night celebration.
He wrapped up the mask then tucked it into a shopping bag that featured the image of a grinning bodybuilder hiding his privates behind a Santa cap. Hugo lumbered to the side table, his hand hesitating over the bottle of absinthe for a moment before dropping back to his side. He seemed, at last, to have begun feeling the effects of the alcohol he'd been putting away since before Daniel's wake. His eyes met Alice's, and he gave a slight shrug.
I had no idea, Polly, you were so sentimental.
I feel,
Polly said, pausing as his face began to crumple.
Everything. Deeply.
He looked up with vulnerable, mournful eyes.
So very deeply.
His tremolo turned to a growl, and his face to cool stone.
Though never quite as deeply as I'd like.
He made a wide gesture toward the array of remaining masks.
And you?
He said, addressing Alice. She scanned the wall, then chose, almost as a joke, the most ridiculous of them all, a cat's face with a feathered headdress. The cat, please. Apollo froze and shared what seemed to be a meaningful glance with his sister. Alice had believed there were no limitations, but the duo seemed to fall into a silent debate.
It's okay, she said, thinking she must have by accident chosen one they were unhappy to lend, whether its value was of a sentimental or monetary nature.
I can wear another, she said, then added quickly to circumvent making another mistake. Perhaps you could choose for me.
No, no, petite Alice, Polly said. This is the mask you chose, and it is the one you must wear.
He removed it from the wall slowly and regarded it with what looked to Alice like reverence.
It's only, Art said, drawing closer. It's only the Gospel of the Witches tells us the goddess Artemis once disguised herself as a cat to seduce her brother, the Shining One.
Alice found herself uncertain how to respond to this unexpected bit of salaciousness.
Not to worry, Polly said,
wrapping the mask with more care than he had the zany.
My virtue has always remained safe with my own Artemis.
He placed the mask in the bag. His sister dismissed his interjection about their given names with an impatient wave of her hand.
Your own family's lore posits you are descendants of the result of this coupling.
Aradia,
Hugo said, nodding. His face wore an expression that somehow managed to be at once smug and disdainful.
Of course, it's only a myth, but the stories those who came before us told do attempt to describe forces that defy a more direct explanation.
Art held out her hand.
The fallen god.
Starting with her thumb, she began to tick off each of her points with one of her digits.
The queen of heaven. Your choice of disguise, your brother Nicholas's attempt to resurrect the longest night. Burning a wicker man at the bend in the river we affectionately referred to as the end of the world. Mock me as Cassandra if you must. After all, no one listened to her either. But I'm more convinced than ever we're headed toward our personal Armageddon.
Okay, Alice said. But I think you're making connections where they really don't exist. Besides, I don't remember any myth involving Apollo's demise, so I don't think you can consider him a fallen god.
Oh, ma chère.
Her lips pulled into an embarrassed smile.
Perhaps not in the guise of Apollo, but certainly you've heard of Lucifer.
She lifted her drink to her lips and made a study of Alice's features. Alice fought to maintain a passive expression.
Perhaps, Art continued.